So I am delighted to be interviewing again Professor Mike Hardy. He's a founding and executive director of the Center for Trust, Peace, and Social Relations at Coventry University in the UK. I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit about the awards you've gotten for people to understand the wisdom you bring to our conversation, especially about peace.
So you may be overstating it, Maureen, but thank you for that. The British system is, some argue, very archaic and quite bound in tradition. But we do have an honours system in which achievements are recognised. Many of us who receive honours, which is brilliant, and it's great for the family, great for our co-workers and so forth. So I'm now an OBE, an officer of the British Empire. I've fought all my career, all my academic career and my political and social career, fighting the concept of imperialism. And yet I'm an officer of the British Empire.
So what is an officer of the British Empire?
The royal family introduced historically medals and awards to recognise people. The officer of the British Empire is simply a medal. It's an award. You go to Buckingham Palace, the Queen invests you, and it recognises your contribution to the nation, its relationships and so forth. I think they're really, really powerful. If you have platform and you use it, it extends your platform. And increasingly, of course, these awards are not going to the great and the good, the part of the elites and establishment. They're going to ordinary people who make a significant contribution to good things. There was also a way, of course, of rewarding public servants who didn't get the rewards of huge salaries, health plans and so forth. So as another way of recognising. It's really about recognition.
So, and when we last spoke, the Peace Centre had doubled in size and significantly increased in impact. Tell us what's happening with the Peace Centre.
So it's a really good story, and it's very little to do with me per se. It's got a lot to do with the concept and the idea that we sold to the growing group of people that are involved. So Coventry is UK's City of Peace and Reconciliation, and that goes back to traumatic experiences during the Second World War and the way in which Coventry bounced out of that trauma into very positive things. It's the most twin city in the world. It has more fellow partner cities, all driven by a shared trauma in their history or their past. So Dresden, which was terribly bombed during the war as well. We had a visionary university leader in 2010-11. The vice chancellor, as we call, and her deputy, very clearly saying that this university sits in the heart of this city and doesn't contribute to the iconic state of the City of Peace and Reconciliation. And of course, what Coventry does is promote good things everywhere by its iconic nature. A few of us at the university at that time were working in related areas. I was really interested in the challenges of multicultural communities and cohesion in local cities that were becoming hugely diverse. Others were looking at peace and conflict in terrible wars going on around the world. And in the business school, they were looking at issues of trust. So one weekend, we put together a concept that said, why don't we bring together scholars from the business and management schools that could help us look at trust, at how it might be built, this notion of coming in, walking in and racing out that was referred to at this conference, at the ILA conference, how long it takes to build trust and how quickly you can lose it. If you're interested in peaceful relations, trust is a huge issue. But actually, traditionally, it's never been widely discussed in political science and international relations. So we brought some scholars from the business school, we brought peace scholars together, and my work on intercultural dialogue and social psychology. And we formed the Center for Trust, Peace and Social Relations. It's a multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary center. The university bought into it big time.
Okay.
They're amazing. We thought that we would just develop this thing like an acorn. I always have this passion about growing oak trees, you know, but I know it takes 300 years.
Are you going to be around then?
Yes, I'm absolutely.
They're going to clone you.
No. So they invested £20 million sterling over 6 years. This is unheard of.
A huge investment.
Yeah, this isn't an endowment from a rich philanthropist. This is the university saying this is a good idea and that we want to form our future in that direction. That gave us core funding of around £3.5 million a year for 6 years. And we said we will spend 3 years building this thing and we will spend 3 years delivering impact, results, credibility, credentials. Okay, they said. So off we did. And when I spoke to you last, I think we were at the end of our sort of 3 or 4 years, the first period, and we'd assembled the best part of 60 scholars. If I tell you they're 21 different nationalities, we operate in 18 different languages, we scoured the world for the best scholars, not necessarily the most published, the most famous, mm-hmm. but people who would work in a collegiate way around the principles that we discussed. For example, we have 3 principles that matter, and when we recruit people, they either buy into those or we don't recruit them. Teams come first. Team first is our first principle. So the academy's full of prima donnas, that's great, and we need them. It's full of eccentrics, full of people who are just amazing individuals. We want the old and the young. We want hierarchy-free academy in which experienced academics work with early career researchers to bring richness of that generation combination. So we do. Everything's in teams.
That's an important point to reiterate. You have talked about that in a range of areas in our conversations. The hierarchy-free means ideas are flowing every direction. Young people are encouraged and treated as equals with respect.
Yeah. I'm a great believer in the power of youth and its energy and its ideas, its innovation, take risks and so forth. But I'm also a believer in the power of experience and moderation and caution. And those of us who look to the next generation to solve our problems, fine. But actually, I prefer to talk about this generation, the now generation, I call it. We're all here. By creating a center which was driven by team first, what it does is it brings valid contributions from whoever's a member. The second is we have a lot of freedom of action. It's not a permissions culture. Often leadership and management creates an environment, even good leadership, but it's still raced around permissions. So we try to remove permissions by giving people space to take responsibility for their decisions, but they're accountable. So the second principle is accountability. You get a lot of freedom, but you're held to account. I'm held to account, and so is the most recent and the youngest member of our team. And the third is that we try and avoid doing anything that doesn't have a long-lasting impact, a legacy. So quick fixes, I don't allow. Someone will come along and say, well, we've got £25,000 here, do this project, we need the results tomorrow, and it's a one-off report, it'll be published, and that's it. And we say, no, what's the consequence of this? The intended consequences and the unintended consequences. So those 3 principles, they're important to share with you because that's how we recruit it. We now have 68 full-time researchers. We also are able, because of the investment by the university, not to have fixed-term contracts. We don't have people here for 2 years while they do a project and then disappear. So we're able to offer permanent tenured positions to all our researchers. That's quite unusual.
68 tenured positions?
Yeah.
Wow.
Under labor law in Europe, this is not that strange because after 3 years you get, you know, under our systems and so forth.
Okay.
You have protection, your jobs and so forth. But it means that your young researchers aren't beavering away for 2 years and then looking over their shoulders for their next project or their next employment. The other thing, we work really hard as a leadership team on retentions. If we found these people, we jolly well want to keep them. So we have very, very high retention rates. We've lost 3 people in 6 years.
What do you do to retain people?
Part of it is the involvement, engagement, and the removal of strict permissions. Part is that. And I think it's also to do with opportunity. If we can run the Center for Trust, Peace, and Social Relations in the way that we want to achieve trust, peace, and social relations outside, it's very engaging. It lets people pursue their passion. So emotional intelligence and passion is huge in the center, and people have space for that. It's very diverse, so we don't put down people who have radical ideas. We're quite open. And it's difficult. It's very hard. We have conversations in the center with visiting academics, which in some contexts would be banned because they come from a particular ideological standpoint. Mm-hmm. But we're quite open and we allow that to happen.
Somebody made the comment yesterday that these different ideas aren't contagious.
Yeah.
They're not going to jump on you and take over your brain. It's the opportunity that the broader information I listen to, it may stretch something in my brain and all connected to something completely unrelated.
Yeah.
And it's that synthesis and synergy that happens with disparate ideas that does not happen with similar ideas.
We're creating our own agenda, and that's attractive. The other thing that's quite attractive to researchers is that we don't have a lot of teaching. We don't have teaching in some campus-based programs. It distracts. It crowds out. It's hugely an imposition to some researchers. We teach, but we don't have any campus-based programs. Our teaching is, we have PhDs, of course, which are campus-based. The others are all focused on engaging with mid-career professionals in the field, in their workplace. So we do it online. We bring them for workshops. But we don't have students.
In the traditional university sense.
Yeah, so we're very fortunate in that. Because they're necessary because they bring huge revenue. But the university has given us that space to create rigorous, robust research, new ideas. And as you said, when you have free-flowing ideas, it's attractive to young and to experienced researchers. And by golly, we've had some very innovative things that have jumped out. And they've become very, very attractive to funders. Which, you know, part of our deal with the university was that, all right, you can subsidize us for the first 6 years, but then we've got to earn our corn. We've got to get out there. I'm delighted. This last year, the fifth year, we exceeded our revenue targets by £1 million. This is a huge amount. If you've got a £3 million investment, I think we earned last year about three quarters as much again in external funding.
And I think that's what's important for listeners.
Yeah.
Where are we as a global society investing? Because we hear what we hear in the news, and it's often hard to put it into context. Are we safer or less safe?
Yeah.
Are we democratic or more democratic? Sure. We heard Henry say yesterday, 4.5% of the world's population lives under healthy democracy versus flawed democracy.
And it's just not acceptable, is it? I mean, it's just no way to run a world. Look at some of the ideas, let me share, that have come up, and some of the combinations of scholars that are now working effectively. We now have a group of scholars in the center who look at faith and peaceful relations. So we had theologists, we had those interested in the current diversity of faith and belief, in particular Western societies, in the role of Muslims in Europe and so forth. But we put those that were interested in faith and values and beliefs together with those who are interested in how we mobilize faith, values and beliefs to create a more peaceful world. So the peace that we promote in the center, in our thinking, is not the peace that's the antidote to conflict. It's not a peace that you impose on disorder. It's a positive peace, as Galtung talks about, that's value in its own right. And actually, it's a peacefulness that's as important in families, a conflict and domestic violence is a critical issue, as it is in mega international disputes over territory or over energy sources. The peace we discussed is about social relations, which are positive and supportive rather than conflicted.
I think last year our interview was actually titled, What If We Were a Peaceful Species?
Yeah, so it's a big assumption. Do we assume that we're born to be competitive and conflict with one another? Or does something happen to us on our journey that creates that? I don't know the answer to that, but it's certainly worth debating. It's certainly worth discussing. But we worked last year with Steve Killaley from Australia, who's developed the Index of Peace. His index shows that we're more peaceful now than we've ever been. Well, it certainly doesn't feel that, does it? But I'm not
really... when I open my phone and see the news flashes, and it's conflict here, conflict there, but they're not the same level of deadly conflict.
Sure. I think we are in a world that's generally getting hold of this issue, where violence is being pushed back as a way of resolving personal relational issues and so forth. We're not there yet. What I worry about, of course, is that the conflict is moving from that conflict between nations, although we still have that, to conflict within communities or within families or within very close-knit localities. We need to work more on that. So our faith and peaceful relations team are really insightful. For example, what's the role of a university chaplain? We've done big research on the role of faith representatives among student bodies.
Nancy Adler said people who have a strong basis in faith, and it doesn't matter which faith, seem to have more confidence and less fear than people who don't. How do we create within a company? Because the other interview I just finished was with a researcher talking about people's willingness to follow people who are different. 54% of the population will follow someone of a different gender. That's a bit problematic. Only a third would follow someone of a different political party. But it seems like there is, in the more granular elements of society, a lot of work still to be done.
Well, the psychologists and their research help us a lot. Gavin Sullivan is one of our professors, does a huge amount of work on contact theory and around the issue of how much you bounce into people of difference and how you do that. In some of my work on intercultural dialogue, I noticed that people got stuck on encounter. So when I meet Maureen, we sit and we meet each other, and that's fine. Following the encounter, we have to exchange, and we do. And it's interesting, isn't it? Encounter itself is a necessary but not sufficient part of a relationship. So exchange is really important. So we share things. You find out about each other. But even that's not enough. You know, if you go from encounter to exchange and then move on to engagement, then that makes a real difference. So we meet each other, we exchange things. It's only then when we engage with each other that the relationship becomes sustainable.
And the differences, not just the commonalities.
That's right. It's always clever to have ease, isn't it? Encounter, exchange, and engage. But what happens then if we enact, if we do something together? And I've been looking at that. The research I've done has been actually talking to big people, to world leaders. We've had some great examples here. So I've asked people, what do you think about this progression, moving from where contact theory says we should spend more time with each other to actually engaging and doing things together, which is rather different?
When I engage, when you and I have dialogue, is it that we build on the commonality? We are open to difference? Does the theory speak to maybe the both?
So I think it's the way we deal with both commonality and difference. It's the way in which we cope with it. It's a coping mechanism that we improve, we strengthen. I think also that we build shared action or shared visions of things that, and insights that we might not have had before. I'll hear something from you and I'll go away and process it and I've changed, you know.
Well, and that's what's been so fun about our interactions, because they're now happening every year, and I learn from you and I use things that you've told me. I integrate them into my work. But we haven't worked closely enough that we've had conflict. Or at least I have not had conflict.
We could try, couldn't we? Yes, no, I agree, yeah.
So it is largely built on shared values around building leadership.
Because actually our conversations are like a journey where we have probably an agreed destination we're trying to achieve. We have a very imperfect journey. You know, we've got a satellite navigation that keeps changing its mind all the time. And that's the exploration in the conversation. But actually the reason that we don't have a conflicted discussion is probably because we have a shared destination, even if it hasn't been explicit. And that's about exploring things that will be of interest to those people who might listen. And they're focused around some themes, you know, leadership and influence.
I also have the belief that if we differ, that's okay. I don't have to thump you over the head. You don't have to thump me over the head. We don't have to agree. We express a difference, and then we both go away and process.
So in my career, I stumbled into context in which I found quite alien, very different. I think I've told you before, I was sent to Cairo for 3 years as an advisor, and operated there. I went to Jerusalem. I lived for 4 years in Indonesia. And actually, not everything was familiar. It's culturally different. Not everything was easy to accept. Sometimes the patriarchy I found really difficult, and the role of women or the role of young people. I found the poverty really difficult to process. There are different ways in which you react to that. Things that you really disagree with. You can campaign and fight and become a righteous person, or you can begin to process it differently and try to understand it. And I think what happened is I still get angry about it. I don't have anger, but I get disappointed and frustrated. But I process it differently and try not to build differences, but to build shared appreciations, if you like. What it taught me was that the power of respect for difference, respect for people who are really passionate and have strong feelings that I don't. But you need to give them space and say that there has to be a way. It's the most powerful potential destructive force that we have, our inability to live with difference.
Mike, you've talked a little bit about your center and the wish that as we go forward on the planet, that we connect with our sense of being peaceful beings.
The center we've created and the team that we've assembled has a future. That's the first point to make. And if you have a future, that always says to me, you know, you need a sort of a destination. You might never reach it, but you have a direction of travel. We have a lot of collaborative work within the center, a lot of flat structures so that people have a voice. And one of the things we've developed around is our clearer understanding of where the future of the scholarship we provide. The center is a research center. It's unapologetic about that. That's our job, is to create evidence, to create new ways of thinking, to create better conceptual frameworks that will amplify and help explore some of the challenges we face. We focus in two ways. One, we're trying to look more carefully at recognized global challenges. So peace studies in the past quite often, and rightly, focused heavily on conflict and post-conflict situations, mm-hmm. how to build the peace and how to keep the peace, central to the literature and a lot of the research. And as a result, we got much greater and stronger understanding about the best forms of post-conflict scenarios and mm-hmm. post-conflict strategies. But you know, if we step up to the global challenges we face, some of them aren't necessarily conflicts between nation states. Some of them aren't the following a battlefield. Some of the global challenges we face are simply because of the nature of processes currently at work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 70 million people on the move who aren't able to stay in their homes. Now, to you and I, that's quite a challenge just thinking about it, because we have, you know, we're probably lucky to have a home and mm-hmm. have a home that's quite safe and secure, and we go back to it every night. 70 million people don't. So we have a whole load of people, shed loads of people who are displaced.
No immediate plan to go home.
And no prospect either sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, they have to start building again. And there are wonderful stories that we could share of people who are uprooted and rerouted and make a lot of it. But there are those who don't. So we're looking at what scholarship do we need and what mm-hmm. can we sponsor at the center to help understand the plight of displacement and what that does. What do we mm-hmm. need to understand to address it better, to meet the challenge better? What policies should we be promoting mm-hmm. to help? I may well have told you this story before. One of the most powerful narratives that I had in my center from a couple of years ago were the conversations that researchers, led by Heaven Crawley, my professor of international migration, conversations she was having with Syrian and Afghan refugees as they arrived in Greece. Just think this through. You could ask, you know, well, what do you need? What help can we give? You can do all sorts mm-hmm. of things. Imagine asking someone getting out of a boat provided by a trafficker, what did you do in the last hour before you left your home in Aleppo?
I remember you talking about, what's the one item you take with you?
Yeah, that's another one. Remember that? So mm-hmm. what this was telling the researchers is that these people weren't making permanent movements. They were actually fleeing a situation. If that situation mm-hmm. were to change, they could go home. So shouldn't that then look and inform policymakers how better to deal with this global challenge? Don't treat them as threats. Treat them as displaced. Treat them as vulnerability. Treat them as people mm-hmm. that need to have a cuddle, need mm-hmm. to have a hug before they go home again. Mm-hmm. And let's get some of the big issues on the political sort of stratosphere that's creating all this turbulence and mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. So where that's taken us, there are any little examples, where that's taken us is to say, our research, we should be looking more at peacefulness than just at peace. Peace is a state of affair. Peacefulness mm-hmm. is a feeling, if you like. So yes, the index might say that we're more peaceful now than ever before in the world. And so what do we need to create? What do we need to do? What understanding do we need to share through our scholarship, through our research, to help build mm-hmm. a more mm-hmm. peaceful place, a more peaceful way of you and I relating when we come into mm-hmm. conflict, however meet. You know, if I'm sitting in your seat on the train and I have a reservation and you have a reservation and some computer somewhere has made this problematic, that is not always peacefully resolved. We're not good at that, particularly if you then overlay that with prejudice, with you're a foreigner, you're whatever.
And just basic fatigue.
Yeah, it sounds airy-fairy, but it really is quite important. I'd like us to understand better the conditions that we need to create in humankind that would lead to more peacefulness and less conflict and less violence.
it seems that that starts with each individual.
Yeah.
It also starts with government and policies, and I understand that. I'm not being either delusional. How do I live peacefully with you, with my partner, with my neighbors?
I've begun to look more at spiritual scholarship and at humanism and all sorts of things that might shed a bit of light on how to get yourself in a place. I spoke at the Spirit of Humanity Forum held in Reykjavik. I was so touched to be invited. Mm-hmm. And because I went thinking, well, it's all right, man. You can tell everyone about your center and how wonderful it is, because I do that all the time. When I got there, David Cadman, who's a wonderful guy, he said, Mike, we don't want you to tell us about your center. We know about your center. We can see it online. We don't want you to tell us what you do. We want you to tell us why you do it. That was an education for me. I had to rush off to the hotel room to have a think. Spontaneous Mike, he's not, you know. I can appear to be. But actually, it's a very powerful point that he was making. What is it inside Mr. Mike that leads him to push in the way that we have, to build the sorts of centres, to attract people to come and work?
What was the kernel of wisdom that you shared with that group?
Well, I told them my life's journey and how I started as quite a self-seeking, ambitious economist. And in my first career as a professor of economics, I was probably the youngest in my department at Leeds. Something happened along the road in which it exposed me to and challenged me to think more widely than my own little thing. Partly because I was very fortunate and traveled a lot and I worked and lived in other countries. And I was confronted with alien contexts and difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it led me quite quickly to say, of many things that we need to be, one of them is we need to be more comfortable with difference. We need to be more able to cope when difference presents itself. And along with the pace of change, I think one of the greatest aspects of turbulence these days is not change. It's the pace of change. It's how quickly things change. Coming to terms with that, we're very poor, very weak. Mm-hmm. We don't spend enough time in our schools helping young people become more adaptive and more flexible. We just expect that they're going to be. So I think there is work we can do, and that drives what we do. So when you think more about why you do something, I want to change the world, but I'm also humble enough to know that that has to be done in collaboration with many other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to create this notion that I often use, that life isn't a series of moments, it's a movement, it's a whole program. Why do I do what I do? Because I can make a tiny little bit of change in an early career researcher, fresh out of PhD, who will come and has an illustrious and wonderful career. And if I can get just a little bit of influence at the beginning to say, hey, be a top-ranked scholar, be a wonderfully interesting and inspiring person, but be very clear about your purpose, about why you're doing it. And that's, you know, so the challenge that I was had, I give to everyone else now. That's the best way, of course, because they have cleverer answers than I.
Thank you for sharing your passion about this. You and I, as we were walking into the session, had a conversation about your son challenging you. What were you going to do for your New Year's resolution?
Well, you asked me, you know, what can we do as individuals? Very little. We're tiny people in this huge, complex place. And it was driven a little by that question about why I do what I do. But my sons, we were joking at one stage. I think we were chasing my grandson around, which is what we normally do. Mm-hmm. And he said, what's your New Year's resolution?
Uh-huh.
And I don't do resolutions because I just haven't for many years. You can give things up and say that you're pleased with yourself for doing it. But I reflected on it, Maureen, and I thought, this is actually an opportunity for a leader to lead in a silly way with very small L. And so I decided to give up anger, to give up being angry. You know, I get really engaged with things. I get really passionate about things. I'm so cross that the world is in the state it's in, that one in four people in Britain, kids are brought up in poverty, that we have food banks, that the International Red Cross distributes food in the UK, not just in Africa. You know, this is nonsense. So you could get angry, but actually what I think happens when you're angry is that you damage yourself.
Physiologically, we know this.
And you're less useful in meeting the challenges. So I decided to give up anger. My staff will be better judges than I if I've been successful, But you won't find me angry. You find me disappointed, frustrated, let down, feeling of huge anxiety, but you won't find an angry Mike now. And I feel better for it. I'm more useful as a result, I think. And you know that's infectious. But if I get angry, the reaction is will be that someone gets angry back, and this just propagates into less rational exchanges. Life is all about social relations between people, isn't it? I don't have to like you. I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to like spending any time with you.
Hopefully you do, though.
Of course I do. And that's why it's such an absurd thought. But I need to understand you, and I need to respect you. I need to be able to stand in your shoes sometimes, mm-hmm. and you need to stand in mine. I often say, I've said to you before, the greatest source of human security is our inability to do what I've just described. The fear of the other will kill us all. I mean, we'll be doomed. It's a powerful emotion. When I was a student, when I was a youngster, my class at school, I remember it very well when I was a boy, a very young boy. My mother was American. In the post-war years, there was quite a lot of anti-American feeling in Britain.
I didn't realize she was American, and you grew up in Britain, though.
Yeah, I grew up in Britain. She arrived before I was born and never went home. We were British and English and so forth. But at school, I used to be teased terribly and bullied for having peanut butter sandwiches and having things, a banana in the 50s. You know, in America, it was fine. So in a sense, even though I came from a very safe and common stock, you know, my classrooms at school were not diverse. There was only one language. There was only one set of things, you know. Mm-hmm. Imagine now when your students arrive on campus. So, you know, we have 100 different nationalities at Coventry University, with 80 or so different languages being used in the coffee shops. I mean, it's just a different place, isn't it?
You know, I grew up in D.C. largely, and it is interesting because they're mostly... it's really delightful to hear another language.
Yeah.
But occasionally, it's a little jolting. Like,
it is.
Just, I wish I could understand.
And when I went to Indonesia, I lived there for 4 years, and I was very, very distinctive. I have white hair. I'm a white guy. What was different from home is that elderly people are hugely respected. Mm. The space you give and the respect you get is part of the culture. It's quite endearing.
So you're going to move to Indonesia next?
As you age. But, you know, I was always an expatriate, never a migrant. And it's really interesting.
And that's a very distinct difference.
Because you are whitey, you are Westerner, you were, you know. And actually, the people that I met in Java and Sumatra, they didn't have a great deal of contact with foreigners. But when they did... we were always the expatriate. We were the leaders. We were the influencers. We were the owners or something. It's quite an interesting insight, though, and that's helped as well.
Well, and you were also going home.
Yes.
Yeah. The assumption with an expat is you're temporary, not you're a migrant who the fear is will be permanent.
Sure. But what I see now among young people, you know, the most accepting places in the world are the most diverse places. So it doesn't mean, you know, in London recently voted to stay in the European Union. Mm-hmm. It has less fear of foreigners than other places. It's a hugely diverse place. So there's some lessons here, something for us to dig into and research a bit more. Mm-hmm. London doesn't celebrate, but it acknowledges all the benefits of diversity in quite a warm way. You know, people are less anxious about foreigners and new people. But you can well understand in sort of monocultural places in the country where all of a sudden very different cultures appear. Mm-hmm. We have to work at that. We have to help people cope with this. These are global challenges. Mm-hmm. They're not local to the UK or local to anywhere else.
And yet, again, that getting comfortable with is an individual process.
It is.
What was your process to let go of anger? I'm guessing you didn't just wake up one day and say, I'm never going to be angry again.
I used to be angry. I remember I was probably a terrible son, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember being angry with my children as well when they let me down or when they got into dangerous situations. Mm-hmm. So I reflected. The process was to identify, remember a time or two when you were angry and what happened as a consequence wasn't always positive. So when you started looking at it, it became, why didn't I do this earlier? This actually makes sense. But it's really difficult.
Well, and that's part of what I'm trying to draw the distinction. Even though I know it's the right thing to do, I'm still reprogramming myself to do it consistently.
It really is difficult. And it's, you have to believe in things like dialogue and believe in the long period that it might be that you have to take to resolve something. Mm-hmm. And some people say to me, well, Mike, when I'm angry, I feel better. It resolves things. It clears the air. But
does it?
I don't think it does. I think people can explode and it releases tension.
It releases tension in you, but that's the contagious thing. If I release tension around other people.
So I'm not trained in this. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist in the sense. So there'll be others out there with much better understandings of the things I'm feeling. But I'm a better person. And I don't care what other people think. I know what I judge myself. Mm-hmm. I'm a better person. I'm less angry. I still have my moments, you know. And the other thing that it leads you to have to fill the void. You got rid of anger, so what's there instead, Mike? And you don't become a depressive. You don't want that. But actually what fills it is with empathy, with a stronger understanding of where someone's probably coming from. People used to really annoy me, and I'd get very angry at them for doing very silly things.
I'm imagining most of our listeners have had that experience once or twice.
So what he puts in his place is something like empathy, which is interesting.
It probably has nothing to do with you in most cases, except your kids.
But it'd be very flip, wouldn't it, to just say, well, it's their problem. You know, let them
but
get on with
not.
It. No. But sometimes their anger or their expression or provocation or winding up or whatever they're doing is a quite deliberate strategy. It's a power strategy or... If you're empathetic, you just say, all right, there's something else going on that's not out in the open. My reacting with anger is not going to draw anything out. It's just going to harden lines, you know.
Well, and accelerate their anger.
Yeah.
And I find when I meet anger with anger, mostly it's ineffective.
Yeah.
But there are occasions where it is also appropriate to create the barrier that bounces.
So, and we have to change some of the assumptions that we make. So that being accepting or not getting angry is somehow makes me weak.
It's a more advanced
Hang on, you're a soft touch, Mike, because I can do these outrageous things and, you know, you don't react in a sort of programmed way. So you must be a weakling or so.
Especially as we look at the negotiating strategy in the U.S. right now of our president, that it's all the way in and aggressive. How do people meet that strategy to pivot? And frankly, when that's the primary strategy and everyone knows it, now people are able to manipulate that strategy.
We're at the International Leadership Association Forum. There was a wonderful bit. Somebody said something that I've heard many times before, but reminded me. The difference between leadership and management. Remember this?
Yeah, I do.
To be a good leader, you've got to be a good manager. And to be a good manager, you've got to be a good leader.
I think that was Henry Mintzberg.
Yeah, exactly. And it reminded me. We've heard it before. I've read his work before. And it was a good... But this is a very good example. My thinking more about why I do what I do, my giving up anger and do it, this is about my leadership of my center. It's my responsibility.
And your leadership of yourself. I think we assume that leadership is out there.
Yeah.
And one of my key messages is it's in here first.
Yeah.
And only when I am leading myself am I able to be a leader that people want to follow.
So how can I, if I can't manage myself, how can I manage others effectively? And how can I provide the role model or the leadership that some, you know, early career researchers need?
Most of us need someone that we can resonate with and trust and respect.
Yeah.
And people who are ranting and raving, for many of us, aren't the ones we want to emulate.
So I suppose what I've learned most powerfully, I got thrown into leadership. I just like what I do. And all of a sudden, we've got a big operation. And you have to think continuously about what you're doing and how you're doing it if you want to be effective. It doesn't come automatically. There are no born leaders, in my view. They're constructed by context and circumstance, and you can be good or bad or indifferent, but actually you've just got to be a thoughtful leader. That's the thing.
On that, we so totally agree that if leaders could do one thing, and that's be conscious of what's going on inside and what's coming outside, and how does that match the environment, which isn't an easy request. we could be so much more effective and reduce the conflict, increase the sense of safety that brings about an ability to respond peacefully.
And communication is critical, isn't it? You know, I was so touched the other day when one of my staff came to me and said, "This is what I've done, Mike. I didn't bother you because I knew how you would have done it." And I went away thinking, God, he spent all that money and woof, you know. But actually, he solved the problem he had without recourse to his leader. And the reason he'd done that is because we have a rapport and I clearly have communicated. There was a big tick for me. Occasionally, you can have your own ticks, you know, and praise yourself. But the fact that he came and after the fact, he was done and dusted. He didn't ask, and he should have done, technically, but he didn't need to. And that was great. I love the organization that we have, and it's mostly because they're great people.
Do you have any just parting thoughts about peace, peacefulness, trust, and courage?
So all those are such needy things. We need more of them. And my thoughts are always about how to contribute in small ways to make sure we do. I'm very concerned that we should redefine some of our leadership work into purposeful and leadership for or of peace. And I think we don't do enough of that. And if I have any influence, future ILA conferences will be focusing on that. What can we do as leaders that's more likely to achieve the peaceful relations that we've been talking about today? What can we do? We have to do it, be deliberate, and we have to be measured, but we have to be committed to that. And I don't think all our leaders are really interested in peacefulness. They're interested in propagating power bases or doing other things or competition. But that's what I'd like to put on the agenda. The leadership of or the leadership for peace.
Even the study of power can be for peace.
Yes, absolutely.
It not necessarily negative if used effectively.
So how do we mobilize our capabilities for a particular purpose? But you have to be clear about your purpose. And my purpose is to create more peaceful relations between people.
What a beautiful way to end the conference. Mike, do you have a website that people can learn more about your work?
So yes, go to the Center for Trust, Peace and Social Relations at Coventry University, CTPSR, and you'll find out. And you can get in touch with me.
And that would be by LinkedIn, most likely, just message
you? LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn. It's Professor Mike Hardy as well. Just message it. That'd be great. And
thank
just be
you.
Patient, because I'm not always as quick as I should be.
Thank you, Mike. It's just a delight to get to spend time with you.
Thank you, Laurie.